Expert Panel Sitecast. Differential Diagnosis of Adult Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. Treatment Options and Comorbidity Considerations. Faculty: David Goodman, MD, Roger McIntyre, MD, FRCPC, and Oscar Buckstein, MD, MPH. This CME Sitecast is jointly sponsored by the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and MBL Communications and was recorded on March 27, 2009. Release date: August 31, 2009. Termination date: August 31, 2011. Estimated time to complete activity: 1 hour. Medium: the content is delivered by Sitecast with a PDF or web-based post-test. Acknowledgement of commercial support. Funding for this activity has been provided by an educational grant from Shire Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. Activity review information. The activity content has been peer-reviewed and approved by James C.Y. Chu, M.D. Review date: June 22, 2009. Faculty affiliation. Dr. Goodman is director of the Adult Attention Deficit Disorder Center of Maryland and Suburban Psychiatric Associates in Lutherville, and assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Maryland. Dr. McIntyre is associate professor of psychiatry and pharmacology at the University of Toronto and head of the Mood Disorder Psychopharmacology Unit at the University Health Network in Toronto, Canada. Dr. Buckstein is professor of psychiatry at the Western Psychiatric Institute and Clinic at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine in Pennsylvania. Faculty disclosure policy statement. It is the policy of the Mount Sinai School of Medicine to ensure objectivity, balance, independence, transparency, and scientific rigor in all CME-sponsored educational activities. All faculty participating in the planning or implementation of a sponsored activity are expected to disclose to the audience any relevant financial relationships and to assist in resolving any conflict of interest that may arise from the relationship. Presenters must also make a meaningful disclosure to the audience of their discussions of unlabeled or unapproved drugs or devices. This information will be available as part of the course material. Faculty disclosure. Dr. Goodman is a consultant to Eli Lilly, Forrest, McNeil, New River, and Shire, is on the speakers bureaus of Forrest, McNeil, Shire, and Wyeth, receives research support from Cephalon, Eli Lilly, Forrest, McNeil, New River, and Shire, has received honoraria from Eli Lilly, Forrest, McNeil, Shire, and Wyeth, and is an equity shareholder in Wyeth. Dr. Goodman discusses unapproved and/or investigational uses of bupropion for the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Dr. McIntyre is on the advisory boards of AstraZeneca, BioVail, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly, GlaxoSmithKline, Janssen Ortho, Lundbeck, Organon, Pfizer, Shearing Plough, Shire, and Solvay Wyeth, is on the speakers bureaus of AstraZeneca, BioVail, Eli Lilly, Janssen Ortho, Lundbeck, and Wyeth, receives grant and research support from Eli Lilly, Janssen Ortho, the National Alliance for Research on Schizophrenia and Depression, Shire, and the Stanley Medical Research Institute, and receives honoraria from AstraZeneca, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Solvay Wyeth. Dr. McIntyre discusses unapproved and/or investigational uses of psychostimulants for the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Dr. Buckstein has received research support from Shire. Dr. Buckstein discusses unapproved and/or investigational uses of bupropion and modafinil for the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. CME course director James C.Y. Chu, M.D., is associate professor of psychiatry at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Dr. Chu has received honoraria from AstraZeneca, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly, GlaxoSmithKline, Janssen, and Pfizer. Learning objectives. At the completion of this activity, participants should be better able to predict challenges to diagnosing and managing comorbidities in adults with ADHD, assess current evidence relating to treatment efficacy for adults with ADHD and comorbid depression, bipolar disorder, and substance use disorder, summarize the evidence related to ADHD and substance use disorder and how to minimize misuse and diversion when treating ADHD patients. Target audience. This activity is designed to meet the educational needs of primary care physicians and psychiatrists. Accreditation statement. This activity has been planned and implemented in accordance with the essential areas and policies of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, through the joint sponsorship of the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and MBL Communications, Inc. The Mount Sinai School of Medicine is accredited by the ACCME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. Credit designation. The Mount Sinai School of Medicine designates this educational activity for a maximum of 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. Disclaimer. These are the opinions of the faculty, not of the sponsors or supporters. For more information, contact MBL Communications at cme@mblcommunications.com. Abstract. Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, ADHD, in adults occurs at a prevalence rate that is higher than the prevalence of many major psychiatric disorders in adults. Thus, adult patients with ADHD often present with comorbid conditions, each of which alters the course of ADHD, overall treatment recommendations, and symptoms response differently. Common ADHD comorbidities include major depressive disorder, MDD, bipolar disorder, and substance use disorders. Algorithms have been developed to aid clinicians in determining which presenting disorder to treat first, and additional studies have helped elucidate which pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic treatments best treat each comorbid disorder without worsening symptoms of another. In this expert panel sitecast, David Goodman, MD, discusses the prevalence and diagnostic distinctions between ADHD in adults and depression, including both MDD and dysthymia. Roger McIntyre, MD, FRCPC, reviews the phenomenology, illness progression, and treatment options for patients with ADHD and comorbid bipolar disorder. And Oscar Buckstein, MD, MPH, reviews both background and practical considerations in understanding, evaluating, and treating adults with coexisting substance use disorders and ADHD. Adult ADHD and comorbid depressive disorders, diagnostic challenges and treatment options, by David Goodman, MD.
This is Dr. David Goodman. I'm going to be presenting on adult ADHD and comorbid depression. I think it's important to highlight the prevalence rate of both disorders in the general population, as well as the comorbid rates of both disorders concomitantly. The prevalence rate for major depression is 6.7% in the U.S. adult population, while the ADHD prevalence rate in adults is 4.4%. Looking at the concurrent comorbid rate, if a patient has major depression, the likelihood of having ADHD is 18.6%. If the patients have ADHD, the likelihood of having comorbid major depression is 9.4%. Moving on to dysthymia and ADHD comorbidity, if the patients have dysthymia, then the comorbid rate of ADHD is 12.8%, while those adults with ADHD have a comorbid rate of dysthymia at 22.6%. Moving from prevalence rate, let's talk about diagnostic distinctions, because this becomes a critical aspect of clinical evaluation that often presents challenges and confusion to the clinician. So let's talk about major depression and / dysthymia versus ADHD. I think there are several factors to consider in distinguishing these disorders. Age of onset is important. ADHD is a onset in childhood, whereas most mood disorders, and specifically major depression, has its index case onset in adolescence. Although we know there are cases of major depression and dysthymia in childhood, most of the prevalence rate starts in the adolescent years. So the age onset becomes one distinguishing factor. The presenting symptoms are also distinguishable, yet overlapping. So major depression is primarily a disturbance in mood, whereas ADHD is a disturbance in cognition. Major depression symptoms defined by DSM-IV criteria include sad mood, reduced motivation, negative thoughts, apathy, hopelessness, and neurovegetative changes in sleep and appetite, to highlight just a few of the symptoms. ADHD presentation is domains of inattention and hyperactivity / impulsivity. But we do know that the distribution of combined types is about 65% of all ADHD cases, and inattentive subtype is about 30%, leaving the hyperactive impulsive type at less than 5%. These are prevalence rates in children for subtypes, but this has not been distinguished in the adult population. And the ADHD symptoms tend to be inattention, distractibility, impulsivity, hyperactivity, careless mistakes, forgetfulness, poor follow-through, easily frustrated, and interrupting in conversations. Returning back to major depression, the historical pattern tends to be cyclic and episodic. In contrast to ADHD, it tends to be chronic, pervasive, and impairing. Although cognitive impairment may accompany a major depressive episode, when the major depressive episode remits, the cognitive symptom remits as well. Contrast to ADHD, with concomitant major depression, cognition may worsen during the major depressive episode, but with the remission of major depression, the cognitive impairment persists in the patient with adult ADHD. Often, there's a family psychiatric history that is specific for those patients who have major depression or dysthymia. The family history is more often positive for mood disorders, in contrast to patients with ADHD who have family histories specific for ADHD. So from there, we move to diagnostic prioritization. 40% of adults with ADHD present with a concurrent, concomitant, active psychiatric condition that needs to be evaluated. And what is particularly challenging is that patients, more often than not, will come in to a psychiatric evaluation or a primary care evaluation with complaints of anxiety and depressed mood as an outgrowth of stressful consequence in one's life. Job loss, marital conflict, disappointment in social relationships. And the clinician needs to question and evaluate the presence of ADHD, because often it's the ADHD that's produced the negative consequences that has then resulted in the complaints of depressed mood and anxiety. It's why I advocate evaluating ADHD in adults in every initial psychiatric evaluation, given that the prevalence rate of adults with ADHD is 4.4%, which is actually higher than prevalence rates for schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, OCD, and generalized anxiety disorder. The Texas algorithm that was developed for treatment is an outgrowth of child literature and adolescent literature. And the Texas algorithm does speak to treating the most severe comorbid disorder first and then letting the dust settle to see where the other comorbid disorders are. I think, however, that in adult psychiatry, this may be a little problematic, because if a patient presents with a depressive episode and the clinician doesn't evaluate for bipolar disorder and says that the ADHD is so severe, I'm going to treat that, that we run the risk that the bipolar disorder is going to be exacerbated by the initiation of stimulant or ADHD medication in an unstable bipolar patient. So I do think there are some modifications that will evolve as the adult research in comorbid psychiatric conditions with ADHD becomes more evident. Unfortunately, right now, given the paucity of research in treatment of comorbid disorders with ADHD, it's very much a steep learning curve by clinical experience. Given that you're treating ADHD in the context of major depression or dysthymia, it is important to understand the medications available for ADHD. At this point in time, there are 5 medications specifically recommended for ADHD, those being dexmethylphenidate XR, oris methylphenidate, mixed amphetamine salt XR, Lisdex amphetamine, and atomoxetine. All of these agents are longer acting once daily medications. There are no short acting stimulant medications indicated specifically to treat adults with ADHD. The long acting agent not only control symptoms over the course of a longer period of time, but they're also less likely to provoke extreme mood changes because of their wearing off effect. This eliminates the noise. This eliminates the confusion about patients' moods being an outgrowth of their underlying mood disorder versus a adverse event from the stimulant medication. Given that polypharmacy is often the treatment with many patients with comorbid disorders, it's important to understand drug-to-drug interactions, both kinetic and dynamic. I've included a slide on the P450 system as it relates to the inhibitory effects of ADHD medication and substrate for the P450 system. The summary of this is that for those medications that are currently approved, there are no clinically relevant inhibitory effects on the P450 system. Bupropion, which is not indicated for the treatment of ADHD, although there are positive controlled trials, does have a significant inhibitory effect on 2D6, and that needs to be considered when using substrates that go through 2D6, of which atomoxetine is a substrate. I think it's important in the pharmacologic treatment to consider non-adherence to medication. This is an issue not only for ADHD individuals, but it's also an issue for patients with major depression. The non-adherence rate at 4 months is about 50% for either disorder. And you can see then that non-adherence to medical treatment for these conditions also leads to a likely non-adherence or partial treatment of other concomitant medical conditions. This is an area that needs to be explored in adult ADHD as it has impact on the medical illnesses that adult patients may have, like hypertension, heart disease, and diabetes. I think in summary, for treatment options, not only are there pharmacologic treatments, but there are non-pharmacologic treatments. There are several therapeutic approaches that have been published and researched. I think the trials that are most impressive are the addition of cognitive behavioral therapy to patients with adult ADHD concomitant with medication that has shown that the addition of CBT increases the response and functioning of patients as it is added to stimulant medication. And so I think that clearly reviews very concisely some of the key issues for treating adults with ADHD and concomitant depression or dysthymia.
Bipolar Disorder and ADHD Clinical Concerns by Roger McIntyre, MD, FRCPC.
My topic will be the topic of ADHD and bipolar disorder. During the past decade, a similar composite has emerged for both bipolar disorder and adult attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. First, both conditions have a relatively high prevalence, a low case detection, there's been protracted illness course, high rate of comorbidity, multifactorial etiology, substantial heritability liability, tremendous burden of illness and economic costs, as well as interpersonal and vocational maladjustment. What's also been interesting along with these reports has been emerging scientific studies suggesting implicating common brain regions and neural circuits, subserving essential features of both conditions. During the last decade, there's been an interest in characterizing, reporting on the prevalence of ADHD in individuals who do have a well-characterized bipolar disorder. Results from epidemiological studies are few in number, but are large in their impact. Results from the National Comorbidity Survey Replication indicate that as many as 20% of respondents who screen positive for bipolar disorder will also screen positive for ADHD, up to 20%. Clinical studies also are few, but are few in number, but large in their sample size. To my knowledge, the largest systematic evaluation of ADHD adults in bipolar populations characterized in a clinical sample was reported on by the National Institute of Mental Health Systematic Treatment Enhancement Program for Bipolar Disorder, acronymized as STEP-BD. They reported an overall lifetime prevalence of adult ADHD of 9.5%. Broken down by sex, the rate was reported as 14.7% for males and 5.8% for females. What's important for us to keep in mind is the debate in the DISC census that continues to exist in our field regarding the validity of diagnosing bipolar disorder in ADHD adults in individuals who have bipolar disorder. One of the challenges that we're faced with is, as I stated earlier, is the commonality of both conditions, with the lifetime rate of bipolar spectrum disorders currently reported at approximately 2-4%. This is a rate not entirely dissimilar from the lifetime rate of adult ADHD. The issue of symptom overlap between both conditions is an area that causes diagnostic confusion for many practitioners. For example, some of the features of mania, such as crowded or racing thoughts, distractibility, increased activity or physical restlessness, and loss of so-called normal social inhibitions, are features not only encountered in mania, but may be encountered in some individuals who have adult ADHD. There are, however, some important differences between the phenomenology of adult ADHD and bipolar disorder. The first is a longitudinal difference between the two conditions. And what I mean by that is that ADHD phenomenology tends to be chronic in its expression, while classically bipolar disorder tends to be episodic, in many cases becoming chronic, but more classically episodic. Secondly, adult individuals with ADHD do not typically report increased productivity or increased psychomotor activity resulting in productive changes. Classically, individuals with bipolar disorder will report increased activity, and certainly that would correspond with increase in energy. Thirdly, individuals with ADHD do not typically report a decreased need for sleep or inflated self-esteem, which are very common features in individuals who have bipolar disorder. And I think what's particularly a distinguishing feature between bipolar disorder and adult ADHD is the presence of psychoses, that is, the presence of delusions, hallucinations, or for that matter, thought disorder. These are not features that are commensurate with the diagnosis of adult ADHD. Notwithstanding these important phenomenological differences, clinicians continue to struggle with knowing where the interface or the diagnostic boundary is between ADHD and bipolar disorder. The overarching question is really, what is the relevance of diagnosing ADHD in a bipolar population? Well, the relevance is underscored by results from the earlier cited STEP-BD initiative. That group had reported that individuals with bipolar disorder who also met criteria for adult ADHD reported an earlier age at onset of the bipolar disorder. We know that earlier age onset bipolar disorder is a more virulent bipolar disorder when compared to more typical age onset in the 20s or much later in life. What was also reported by the STEP-BD group is shorter well intervals. In other words, the time from the onset of one affective episode to the time to onset of the second affective episode was shorter, indicating a greater cyclicity and propensity to affective relapse. We've learned during the last decade that depressive symptoms and episodes dominate the course of bipolar disorder. Not only do depressive symptoms and episodes dominate the course, but they portend much of the psychosocial, interpersonal, and workforce maladjustment that is documented in individuals with bipolar disorder. It's now believed that much of the cost of illness in bipolar disorder is driven by depressive symptoms, and currently in the United States, bipolar disorder is considered the most costly behavioral health disorder. Moreover, the STEP-BD group reported that individuals with bipolar disorder and ADHD had a greater propensity to depression, more depressive episodes, and along with that, higher rates of psychiatric comorbidity, typically in the form of comorbid anxiety disorders, substance use disorders, so-called SUD, as well as a history of aggression and violence, which in many unfortunate situations result in confrontation with law enforcement and others. Taken together, the co-occurrence of adult ADHD with bipolar disorder adds to the overall illness burden and carries with it implications for the diagnosis of bipolar, clearly, prognosis for the individual who has the co-occurring condition, as well as the treatment issues. I think we can now speak to the treatment of bipolar disorder and ADHD. First, I'd like to start with guiding principles for treating bipolar disorder pharmacologically. The current recommendations for treating bipolar disorder, as presented in several evidence-based guidelines and algorithms, which are either evidence or consensus-based, is the usage of FDA-approved agents for treating bipolar mania or bipolar depression. During the past decade, there have been more agents approved for various phases of bipolar disorder than there has in the past 10 decades combined. There's been many new agents indeed approved. It's important that treatment selection and sequencing take into consideration phase of illness. The edifice, the foundation of treating bipolar disorder is with pharmacotherapy. Along with pharmacotherapy, and as part of a larger chronic disease management model, one would be considering integrated psychosocial treatment approaches, educational approaches, and indeed a longitudinal care program. The same, or indeed the principles of treating ADHD would not be dissimilar. In terms of the fact that it is a chronic disease management principles are warranted. The foundation pharmacologically of treating ADHD in adults, as mentioned by other members of this panel, includes the use of psychostimulants. They are the best proven agents. And other agents would include atomoxetine as agents of preferred choice. The question clinicians struggle with is the hazards that are posed with utilizing stimulants or agents that might possess stimulant-like properties in an individual who has bipolar disorder. Generally speaking, there is a concern, which has been supported by several lines of evidence, that stimulants may in fact carry with them a hazard for mobilizing an affective episode, that is, a hypomanic, mixed, or manic episode, in the short term, or may destabilize bipolar disorder with long-term exposure. The proscription, that is the avoidance of psychostimulants in bipolar disorder, instantiates ideology over analysis of the data. What I mean by that is that we do not have large, randomized, controlled, double-blind, placebo-controlled trials that have evaluated the safety or efficacy of any stimulant or stimulant-like agent for ADHD in bipolar disorder. The concern around the use of stimulants relates in part to open label data, chart reviews, consensus, and in some cases, clinical experience. Nevertheless, we don't have so-called level one evidence in adult populations. Notwithstanding these facts and the dearth of evidence available in adult populations, there is in fact one small study, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial in a pediatric sample of individuals who had bipolar disorder and ADHD. And this study was presented in the American Journal of Psychiatry, folks, 2.5 years ago, enrolled individuals and stabilized their bipolar symptomatology with divalproex. When bipolar symptomatology was stabilized, subjects were then assigned to either nextamphetamine salt combination or placebo. All subjects were evaluated with typical measures of usual measures of bipolar disorder and ADHD. And what we learned from this, albeit a pediatric sample, is that the adjunctive use of a psychostimulant in this population not only improved the ADHD features when compared to placebo, but seemed to exert a salutary effect on the bipolar symptoms as well. Taken together, this one and only study, indicated that or suggested that the use of stimulants does have a place to play in treating ADHD phenotype in bipolar children and adolescents, with a guiding principle being that the mood should be stabilized first. Clinicians are familiar with being placed in situations wherein they're asked to make treatment decisions in the absence of a unequivocal evidentiary base, and ADHD bipolar adult is no exception. The guiding principle in treating this condition would be choose an agent and select a algorithmic treatments for bipolar disorder concordant with FDA-approved and evidence-based treatment guidelines. If and when the patient continues to manifest features of ADHD, despite the fact mood stabilization has been optimized and the so-called affective symptoms have been well controlled, then there would be possibly a role for the adjunctive use of a psychostimulant. There's no psychostimulant that is approved or proven to be efficacious for ADHD in the adult population or established as safe. All patients with bipolar disorder, regardless of ADHD or otherwise, should have their symptoms tracked with a symptom measurement tool such as a mood diary to evaluate symptom severity, determine the efficacy of the intervention, and to provide an objective chronicling of symptoms over time. The question arises as to whether or not treatment with psychostimulants should be in the short term or long term in individual bipolar disorder. Again, the guiding principle would be that we would be evaluating progress on a case-by-case basis, and I think that the determination of whether or not a patient should be considered for more continuation or long-term therapy would be based on short-term treatment outcomes and quantitative efficacy and tolerability supported by, buttressed by, some of these clinical ratings. There are, in fact, now several lines of evidence that indicate that ADHD adult phenotype is a common occurrence in bipolar disorder. We've learned this from epidemiological and clinical studies. What's important is that ADHD in the adult population comprises an important therapeutic target insofar as ADHD in the adult population carries with it implications for course of illness, symptom presentation, and prognosis. We eagerly await empirical trials that are adequate in their design and sufficiently powered to address the questions that clinicians are asking on a daily basis. In the interim, the safe and judicious use of stimulants might be warranted in some carefully selected patients in an effort to reduce symptoms and improve their overall functional outcome.
Substance Use Disorders and ADHD by Oscar Buckstein, MD, MPH.
In looking at the challenges in treating comorbid ADHD and substance use disorder, we need to certainly clear up a number of issues of misinformation and misconceptions. The truth is, like other ADHD comorbidities, there's a lack of screening, particularly among adult clinical populations who have the psychiatric comorbidity, or for that matter, in this case, the screening for ADHD and substance use disorder patients. Like my colleagues have mentioned, the issue of which condition to treat first, prioritization, and finally, the place of medication management, particularly stimulant medication, is paramount in treatment planning. One of the things in terms of the comparative the prevalence, we know that ADHD, like the other ADHD, is more prevalent in both clinical and community populations of individuals with substance use disorders. Data from a study of almost 2,000 adults admitted to substance use treatment programs in multi-site studies found that about one-third of adults also met criteria for ADHD. This is confirmed some of the data that we've seen from a number of clinical populations of substance use disorders, where increased rates of prevalence relative to the normal prevalence or the non-comorbid prevalence of ADHD is increased. But it also includes the general population. In a general population study covering, 10 countries in the Americas, Europe, and the Middle East, for those with a substance use disorder, for adults with a substance use disorder, over 11% endorse meeting ADHD screening criteria. While that isn't as extensive as we see in clinical population, it represents probably a doubling of the prevalence. The relationship between ADHD and the development of substance use disorder has received a lot of attention in the literature over the past several decades. Most of the past literature suggested that the increased risk of the development of substance use disorders, at least in adolescence into early adulthood, was due to not to the presence of ADHD alone, but rather to the frequent comorbidity with conduct disorder, and then it was conduct disorder that was the active risk factor. However, the results for more recent studies show some variability in that. For example, in a 25-year-old longitudinal study of a birth cohort in New Zealand, they found that conduct problems in childhood and adolescents were generally related to later substance use, abuse, and dependence, even after control for attentional problems and confounders. They found that attentional problems were largely unrelated to later substance abuse, use, and dependence, even after controlling for conduct problems and confounders. However, in another large prospective study of twins, they looked at both dimensional and categorical measures of both ADHD and conduct disorder. For boys and girls, hyperactivity impulsivity predicted initiation of all types of substance use, nicotine dependence, and cannabis abuse and dependence, even when controlling for conduct disorder at two time points. By contrast, the relationships between inattention and substance outcomes disappeared when hyperactivity or impulsivity and conduct disorder were controlled for, with the exception of nicotine dependence. Categorical diagnosis of ADHD significantly predicted tobacco and illicit drug use only, and not any sort of abuse dependence. Well, this brings us up to more clinical concerns, particularly assessment. Many of the same concerns that involve ADHD diagnosis and screening and diagnosis in adults apply to this type of comorbidity. However, it's even more important that one proceed with obtaining rating scales, using other informants, particularly to establish the developmental pattern of ADHD symptoms. Many individuals with any psychiatric comorbidity may present with the appearance of inattention or other cognitive deficits, which are really temporary and related to the state, the abnormal state produced by that psychiatric comorbidity, be it substance use disorder or a mood disorder, for example. So it's very important to go back using other informants, using some sort of paper record to establish that indeed these are persisting, these were preceding symptoms and not just produced by the psychiatric comorbidity. Proceeding on to treatment considerations, there have been approximately a dozen studies that are reasonably well-controlled, randomized, or open studies that have a relatively large subject number. And in these studies that involve both stimulants and non-stimulants, there probably are several conclusions that we can come up with. One is that we need more studies, is that these are not conclusive. We need studies with more subjects, more studies that incorporate alternative methodologies. But the things that we can determine is, one, that medications definitely improve ADHD alone in adults, that medications appear to improve ADHD in adults with substance use disorders. When I say appear, it seems that the relatively robust findings that we see in open studies are only partially seen when we control for those studies. That is, we lose much of the improvement noted. Another conclusion is that medications alone for ADHD do not appear to affect substance use disorder, that they're valuable in treating the comorbidity of ADHD, but they don't, at least according to these studies, appear to affect the substance use or the impairment resulting from the substance use disorder. Among the questions that occur from the literature, treatment literature, are, will improvements in ADHD have positive effects on treatment and recovery from substance use disorder? And the literature does suggest that prospective follow-up literature does suggest that individuals with comorbidity do not do as well as individuals without comorbidity. And this certainly extends to ADHD substance use comorbidity. However, we need studies that really examine the treatment process, that include psychosocial treatments and looking at the ability of individuals to who may receive ADHD medications during their treatment, psychosocial treatment episode. Do they improve better than those who do not receive treatment for their ADHD? That is a question. In terms of treatment recommendations, we do have the fortunate circumstance of having a number of emerging treatments that will help us. Generally, the use of long-acting stimulant agents allow for the treatment of some individuals with histories or active substance use problems with at least less risk of prompting dependence. This is due primarily to the issue of the less rapid response or less rapid action of long-acting stimulants. They get into the brain slower, their peaks are delayed, and this would probably retard, based on what we know about dependence, substance dependence, this would probably retard the development or exacerbation of dependence. And this includes long-acting agents, stimulant agents, such as in methylphenidate, such as orose methylphenidate, or amphetamines, such as mixed amphetamine salts or Lisdex amphetamine. Of course, there are non-stimulant agents that can be used as well, and this includes the FDA-approved atomoxetine. And many individuals feel that for substance abusing individuals or those in treatment, that these are the first line drugs, as opposed to more tertiary drugs in many non-substance abusing samples. There, of course, are a number of other non-approved or non-indicated non-stimulant medications, such as bupropion and modafinil. Modafinil recently has been shown to produce some signs of dependence based on some imaging studies, but its relative riskiness relative to stimulants has yet to be determined. There are a number of agents in development, such as long-acting guanfacine or nicotinic receptor modulator, which may also be valuable in substance-dependent populations. As suggested by the literature, we know that we need psychosocial adjuncts, that treatment alone for the ADHD is not sufficient in individuals with this comorbidity, that they also need attention to their substance use disorders. But what other types of recommendations can we give to the clinician to treat this difficult population? Obviously, we have a number of safety concerns that we have, but one of the issues is to try to not look at substance use disorder as a unitary phenomenon. That is, there's different levels of risk, that one must look at a number of issues before deciding whether to use medications or what medications to use. One would be the type of history an individual has. That is, do they have a history of stimulant abuse or dependence, cocaine abuse or dependence, or something related that might make them more, make stimulants more risky in this population? Or do they have merely a history or active alcohol dependence, cannabis abuse, something not related where a stimulant would pose a less of a risk? This creation of a risk hierarchy would allow clinicians to base interventions at a certain level. For instance, lower risk ADHD substance abuse patients might receive brief office interventions on substance abuse, certain skills, resources, warnings about diversion, and of course monitoring. And that monitoring, of course, would increase as the risk in the individual patient became higher. Of course, when at all possible, family involvement would generally help. As we progress to higher risk ADHD substance abuse disorder patients, our monitoring increases. The inclusion of urine drug screens to monitor other drug use becomes important. These individuals often will not only need a higher level of care for substance use disorder treatment, but you would have a further delay in initiating ADHD treatment. As pertains to the comments of my colleagues, generally ADHD is considered a less emergent issue than substance use disorder or a reasonably severe mood disorder. And finally, definitely in higher risk patients, that the use of non-stimulants should be exhausted before consideration of stimulant medication. It would be nice to establish a period of abstinence in any person with a substance use disorder, but as we search for empirical evidence that stimulants or other medications may actually help the treatment process, we have to consider that we may be starting some of these before they complete active treatment or the acute phase of active treatment. Obviously, one of the biggest concerns of clinicians who treat this type of comorbidity is safety concerns regarding misuse and diversion. And obviously, it requires a lot of oversight. We must consider the other drugs that would be potentially used by this and their interactions. The risk of any cardiovascular effects of concomitant drug use has to be concerned. There are certainly some red flags for diversion or misuse. That is, calls for emergencies, any sort of continued evidence of substance use, demands by the patient for immediate release compounds as opposed to non-stimulant agents or even long-acting stimulant agents, repeated discordant pill counts, lost prescriptions, continuously escalating doses, of course, somatic symptoms, be they as well as symptoms of psychosis or unstable affect, are also signs of potential misuse. In order to look at these red flags and deal with them, there are a number of precautions that we should take as clinicians. Obviously, we should limit and keep track of the pills that we give these individuals. We should obtain urine toxicology screens on a regular basis. Require frequent patient visits. Definitely, if stimulants are used, long-acting agents are much preferable. We need to emphasize that these medications are for regular use, and PRN medications don't quite jive with that philosophy. Finally, in order to prevent use and diversion, and this particularly applies to our college-age population, we should discuss the patient regarding safe storage, not advertising their medications, whether it's to other family members, other friends, roommates, and the like, so as to avoid raids upon their storage. That really covers what I wanted to say about the comorbidity.
The CME post-test and evaluation for this sitecast is available at nbl.cmeoutreach.com. Successful completion of the post-test and evaluation will allow you to claim credit and print a certificate. To read the extended CME expert panel supplement related to this activity, please visit cmesitecast.nblcommunications.com.